Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Life in the American Century by Joseph S. Nye, Jr., narrated by David Colacci. Preface. May you live in interesting times, goes an ancient Chinese blessing and curse. I have. The world has changed dramatically during my life, which has coincided with what is often called the American century. With poetic hyperbole, in 1983, the American Catholic bishops described our era as the first generation since Genesis with the capability of destroying God's creation. For better or for worse, for 40 years, I have lived in interesting times and confronted the existential threat of nuclear weapons. The story I am telling is personal, but I hope it helps historians to look back and our grandchildren to look forward. My earliest political memories are of World War II, the atomic bomb, and the death of Franklin Roosevelt. From a child's point of view, the war was represented by my parents' concern about rationing coupons, conserving gasoline, and defeating evil people. Dropping an atomic bomb on Japan meant we would win, and the boys would soon come home. Little could I have imagined that I would one day visit Hiroshima as a guest of the Japanese government, or that I would be in charge of President Jimmy Carter's policy to stop the spread of nuclear weapons and would win the State Department's Distinguished Service Medal for my work. Subsequently, when I returned from Washington to Harvard, I tried to think through what I had done and wrote a book with the title Nuclear Ethics. During the Reagan administration, I wrote and commented in national newspapers, magazines, and television on nuclear arms control and our policy toward the Soviet Union. Nor could I have imagined that I would then work in Bill Clinton's Pentagon and be responsible for an East Asian security policy that the Japanese dubbed the Nye Initiative, and for which I would one day stand in the Imperial Palace in Tokyo to receive the Order of the Rising Sun from the Emperor of Japan. As I entered my teens, my political imagination was captured by maps colored for areas representing American troops moving up the Korean Peninsula, and then being pushed down again after Chinese troops surged across the Yalu River. I did not imagine that someday I would sit in the Great Hall of the People in Beijing and meet General Chi Haotian, the Chinese defense minister, who as a young soldier had participated in those battles, or attend a 1995 summit meeting between the American and Chinese presidents and hear Bill Clinton tell Jiang Zemin that the United States had more to fear from a chaotic China than from a rising China, echoing an estimate by the National Intelligence Council that I chaired in 1993. Later, in 1999, I wrote an invited editorial for The Economist of London, speculating on whether we were fated to replicate Thucydides' prediction that an established and a rising power were fated to clash. How we handle that relationship is one of the great questions that has preoccupied me, and I will return to it often. But first, let me go back to the beginning. When I was born in 1937, one of every 4 Americans was out of work. War raged in Spain, and Hitler's growing strength portended world war. Mussolini had invaded Ethiopia, and Japan slaughtered Chinese civilians in the Rape of Nanjing. This was also the year Pablo Picasso painted his iconic image of the horrors of the destruction of Guernica. But most Americans, including my family, were strongly isolationist, despite Franklin Roosevelt's efforts to coax Americans to look outward and broaden their horizons. Today, our nation debates whether we are witnessing the end of the American century in which the United States has been the dominant power. Some believe that we are about to be displaced by China, but I have argued that the future is still open. I have lived through 8 decades of an American era that included World War II, Hiroshima, and wars in Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Nuclear Holocaust was always a background fear. School children were told that in the event of a nuclear explosion they should duck under their desks and cover their heads. The Cold War ended without the nuclear catastrophe that hung over our heads, but it was replaced by a period of hubris as America became the world's sole superpower. That unipolar moment was soon replaced by fears of transnational terrorism and cyber wars, and analysts today speak about a new Cold War with a rising China and fear of nuclear escalation following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Our mental maps of the world have changed dramatically over my lifetime. So has our technology. When I was born, there were no real computers. Today, most of us carry a computer in our pocket that would have required a building to house just a few decades ago. I have an even smaller one implanted in my body that paces my heart. In 1937, transcontinental and transoceanic air travel was barely possible. Over the years, I have logged more than 1 million frequent flyer miles on more than one airline. And then, during the COVID pandemic of 2020, I suddenly stopped traveling. Nonetheless, new technology allowed me to give talks on 4 continents in the course of a week without spending a drop of jet fuel. At the beginning of the American era, no one considered the impact of humans on the Earth's climate. Today it is a major concern as we confront ever more intense wildfires, storms, melting glaciers, rising sea levels, and forced migration of peoples. My family is a very American mix of immigrants. Benjamin Nye was a Puritan who came to Massachusetts in 1639, and the house he built is still preserved as a museum in the small town of Sandwich on Cape Cod. One of my ancestors fought in the American Revolution before moving to Maine. My grandmothers, however, were more recent immigrants from Ireland and Germany. My paternal great-grandfather, John Ward Nye, was a farmer from Maine who joined the California Gold Rush but found no gold. Unlike so many New Englanders, I have a grandfather who was born in California but decided to return east to work for another branch of the Maine family that had prospered in New York. When my grandfather fell in love and married Lillian Spaulding, the artistic daughter of an Irish Catholic family that ran the Brooklyn boarding house where he was staying, the staunchly Protestant family was scandalized, and he was forced to resign from the family company. After his mother died of cancer when he was 9, my father was brought up by 2 Baptist old maid aunts, as they were then called. They told him his mother had gone to hell because she was a Catholic. The little boy loved his caring aunts and loved his mother, so he developed a distrust of organized religion. As an adult, my father refused to go to church, but retained a broad belief in God. He sent me and my sisters to Sunday school. I, too, wrestled with religion during various phases of my life, at one time even contemplating a career as a minister. That was not to be. Religious intolerance was intense in 20th century America, but by 1960 I was able to cast my first vote for Jack Kennedy, an Irish Catholic. I never knew my Irish grandmother, but I like to imagine her smiling at this vote by her grandson. America has serious flaws, many of which occupy us now, but we have also had a capacity to recreate ourselves. Growing up, society told me that homosexuality was abhorrent. Today, my wife and I accept and love a transsexual member of our extended family. Racial prejudice was rampant, and I had no African-American friends. Now my granddaughters date across racial divides. Our nation is far from overcoming our original sin of slavery, but we have made racial progress, including the election of a black president. I deeply believe more will come. Without that hope, who are we? As my friend and co-chair of the Aspen Strategy Group, Condoleezza Rice, said in celebrating Juneteenth, 2021, our saving grace as a nation is that we are always working toward a more perfect union, that we may never get to the perfect, but that we are always striving for it. Americans have worried about our decline right from the start. As a fragment of European society that broke off to worship in a purer way, we have long worried about whether we were living up to those standards. American exceptionalism can blind us, but it has deep roots. Today, both our values and our power are changing. Every modern generation witnesses what it believes to be unprecedented changes in technology and society, but not every generation experiences the rise of a nation to global power and suffers recurrent anxieties about national decline. For 8 decades, we have lived in what Time publisher Henry Luce, in March 1941, baptized the American Century. In the 19th century, the global balance of power was centered in Europe, which sent its imperial tentacles around the world. The U.S. was a bit player, with a military not much bigger than that of Chile. As the 20th century began, the U.S. became the world's largest industrial power and accounted for nearly a quarter of the world economy, as it still does today. When Woodrow Wilson decided to send 2 million troops to Europe in 1917, the U.S. tipped the balance in World War I. But afterwards, the U.S. returned to normal, and in the 1930s became strongly isolationist. It is more accurate to date the American century with Franklin Roosevelt's entry into World War II in 1941. It was in that context, to resist isolationism and urge participation in the war, that Luce coined his famous term. Some have referred to an American empire, but our power always had limits. It is more accurate to think of the American century as the period since World War II, during which time, for better or for worse, America has been the preeminent power in global affairs. With 5 years as a political appointee in the State Department, Pentagon, and intelligence community, I spent enough time in Washington to witness American power up close and occasionally play a part in it. Time and U.S. News described me as a member of the foreign policy establishment, and I served on the boards of organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Atlantic Council, and others. At the same time, my career as a Harvard professor and dean whetted my curiosity about America's role and power in world history, and I have spent a lifetime trying to understand and interpret it. In 1990, while writing a book questioning the concept of American decline, I invented the concept of soft power, the ability to get what one wants through attraction rather than coercion or payment. The term has subsequently been widely cited. A quick Google search shows millions of citations, but the most surprising was in 2007, when the President of China declared soft power to be their national objective. That led to countless requests for interviews, including a private dinner in Beijing, when the foreign minister asked me how China could increase its soft power. A concept I outlined while working at my kitchen table in 1989 was now a significant part of the great power competition and discourse. My interest in developing the concept was to explain how American power rested not just on our economic and military might, but also on our values. Historians sometimes divide the American era into 4 overlapping phases: the post-war liberal order up to the 1970s, the neoliberal market order that began with Reagan in the 1980s, the sole superpower era, following the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 until the Iraq War and the financial crisis of 2008-2009, and now the 4th phase, which is ongoing and is marked by populist reaction to globalization and the rise of China. In 1945, the U.S. represented nearly half of the world economy and had the only nuclear weapons. The Soviet Union broke our atomic monopoly in 1949, but it was not until 1970 that our share of the world economy returned to where it had stood before World War II, to 1/4. President Nixon and others interpreted this return to normal as decline and broke the dollar's tie to gold in 1971. The U.S. remained the world's strongest military power as well as the largest economy, but since the 2010s, China has become a near-peer economic competitor, and large parts of our country have reacted negatively to the disruptions caused by globalization. As yet, this contemporary era has no fixed label. As one author commented, "The order will remain American because of the centrality of the U.S. dollar, but it will become increasingly diverse in the social purposes that it enshrines." One of the great questions for the future will be what happens to American and Chinese soft power. In 2015, I published a book titled, "Is the American Century Over?" Will the U.S. still be the strongest power in 2045? After looking at potential challengers, Russia, China, the European Union, India, and Brazil, my guess was a tentative yes, but with the warning that we should not expect the future to resemble the past. And my optimism has been tempered by the recent polarization of our society and politics. That book was full of facts and figures. This book is about my personal story of what it felt like to live through this American century. Telling stories is an important way for humans to create meaning in their individual and collective lives, but the audience or reader is at the mercy of the storyteller. Fortunately, I kept diaries for 50 years, including those I spent in government. Diaries help protect against the rosy glow of the past. Nonetheless, while I have checked memories against my diaries and contemporary accounts, storytellers always resemble people trying to describe an elephant while wearing blindfolds. We touch different parts and they feel different. It is difficult to describe the whole. Selection is a necessary part of storytelling, but I have tried to tell a true story as best I can. 1. The early years. Because the local hospital was overstretched as a result of a flu epidemic, I was born at home in South Orange, New Jersey, a leafy suburb of New York. Every day my father took the train to Hoboken and a ferry boat across the Hudson to Wall Street, where he was a junior partner in Freeman & Company, a bond trading firm started by distant cousins and neighbors from the Kennebec Valley in Maine. He'd started as a messenger boy at age 15, when his family ran out of money at the end of World War I. He never graduated from high school or college, but over the years filled in with evening classes at New York University, NYU. While he was proud when I earned a doctorate from Harvard in 1964, he loved to tease me about how long it took me to get educated. When I later became dean of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, I donated a tree in his memory in the school's courtyard. My father and I were close, and I was very proud of him. He had an enormous influence on me, but there was always a bit of tension related to competition and independence. While my father was a natural extrovert, my mother was an introvert, stoical and quietly strong-willed. She grew up in South Orange, one of two daughters of a divorced mother who was the daughter of German immigrants. When my grandmother later came to live with our family, she and my mother would speak German when they wanted to keep secrets from the children, particularly around Christmas time. My mother graduated from Columbia High School and attended Smith College, but had to drop out after her freshman year for financial reasons. She worked as a secretary in New York, where she met my father. They were a loyal couple, but almost polar opposites as personality types. I sometimes think I'm more like my mother, but like all humans, I am a hybrid. The 1940s. FDR and Truman. During World War II, when I was in kindergarten, my parents moved 30 miles west to New Vernon, a rural hamlet of a few hundred people. My father doubled his daily commute so that my three sisters and I could grow up on a farm. We lived in a white clapboard colonial house across from an old Presbyterian church. Although we were in the center of the town, behind the house we had a 100-acre farm with barns, chicken and pig pens, and flowing fields and deep woods for a child to explore. Dad hired a farm manager, but also insisted that we children work on the farm, picking and storing apples, harvesting and grading potatoes, shucking field corn, helping to take care of the cows, pigs, and chickens. On Saturdays, it was often my job to kill, pluck, and dress a chicken that we would eat for the Sunday noon meal. Another job I had as a boy in New Vernon was to mow a patch of lawn with an old-fashioned push mower, for which I was paid 25 cents. If I forgot, I was chastised. Rather than being given an allowance, we children were given tasks to earn money to encourage our independence. Having grown up poor and survived the Great Depression, my parents were quite frugal despite accumulating wealth. My father was not interested in conspicuous consumption or having children who flaunted wealth. New Vernon was a small community. One stoplight, one church, one grade school, one gas station, one small village store which doubled as the post office, and a volunteer fire department where square dances were held on Saturday nights. Our farm manager was the caller, and I loved to attend as a kid. Everybody knew each other, everyone was white, and almost all were Republican. One evening my father warned us that a Democrat was coming to dinner, but not to worry because he was a contractor and they had to be Democrats. We bemoan our political polarization today, but partisanship was intense when I grew up. FDR was president at the beginning of Henry Luce's American Century. He had saved democracy in America during the challenge of the Great Depression, and he had overcome isolationism and led the United States into World War II. But FDR was no hero in rural Republican New Vernon. At the time of his death in April 1945, I was walking home from the township school in our little village when one of my first-grade friends echoed his parents' view of FDR by proclaiming, "The tyrant is dead." Similarly, Harry Truman was an important president who launched the 1948 Marshall Plan in Europe and the creation of NATO in 1949. But in New Vernon, many people dismissed him as an accidental president who would soon be voted out of power. On the eve of the November 1948 presidential election, my father sent me to bed before the results were known, but assured me that, when I awoke in the morning, Thomas Dewey would have defeated Harry Truman. The Chicago Tribune made that same mistake with its premature, much-photographed iconic headline, "Dewey Wins." Our country is politically polarized today, but extreme partisanship is not new. It goes back to the early days of the Republic. Beneath the sense of Republican community, there were also severe class and ethnic differences. At our little primary school, Harding Township School, it was more important to be an athlete than to be rich, and if you were from a very poor family or had an Eastern or Southern European name, other kids talked behind your back. Race was not an issue because there were no African-American students. Years later, when my wife and I bought a house in a small New Hampshire town, I was fascinated to find a similar social structure. I have always been amazed at the ways in which humans, like the chickens we raised, work out pecking orders. On the surface, rural life may appear to resemble Edward Hicks's famous primitive painting of the Peaceable Kingdom, but appearances can be deceptive. A small community has both pluses and minuses. I came from a wealthier family than the average, but I was not an athlete. I had few neighbors to play with, and I was younger than the other kids in my class, which at that age was a disadvantage. I was usually near the last to be picked when sides were chosen for games at school. Unfortunately, this did not drive me to excel in my academic work, which held little status among my peers. Some of the most popular kids had stayed back in previous years, and that made them bigger, stronger, and bossier. My academic goal was just to get by, which I did. When a teacher spoke to my parents about underachieving and assigned me extra homework, I treated it as a punishment, not an incentive. Kids will only learn when they are ready to do so. Though I did like to read, my favorite activities involved being outdoors. I loved to hunt and fish. The center of our village had a crossroads with a blinking stoplight. Down the hill from the crossroad was a pond amidst open fields where I would catch sunnies and catfish and bring them home for my patient German grandmother to cook. In an age before cell phones and computer games, radio and television were our other sources of entertainment, but the screens were small and the programs were few. More often I played outside, where I crept through the woods and constructed forts of logs and reenacted the fantasy of defending our farm. Or I would ride my bike to a friend's house or a few miles further to fish for trout in Primrose Brook in Jockey Hollow, where George Washington's troops had spent the winter of 1779. What I learned from growing up in rural New Vernon in the 1940s was self-discipline and self-reliance. I had a few good friends, but there were not many kids to play with. I wasn't a lonely child because I had a large, warm family that gave me confidence, and my father was generous with praise and strict with criticism when deserved. I learned self-initiative, which served me well during my college years when I had a summer job in a mining camp on the Alaskan border and hitchhiked alone across the country. I benefited from that self-reliance later, too, as a young researcher in East Africa, and when I joined the State Department and felt like the proverbial child thrown into a pool and told to swim or sink. America today is divided between urban and rural cultures, and while the population trends favor the cities, our federal constitution gives rural areas a persisting political power. Growing up in rural America has helped me appreciate that culture, but even more important, it gave me a deep love of nature and the outdoors. In the 18th century, the German philosopher Immanuel Kant said that two things filled him with awe, the starry heavens above and the moral law within. When I become too discouraged with my study of the latter and disillusioned by the many terrible ways that humans treat each other, I can always find solace in the former. This came in very handy when the pandemic struck in 2020, when my faith was restored by raising baby chicks and my vegetable garden flourished from the additional attention. I've maintained a vegetable garden all my life. I love watching things grow. Over the years, I have received numerous honorary degrees, but one of my favorite prizes is a purple ribbon I won for a cauliflower that was rated the best vegetable in the show at a local New Hampshire fair. The Eisenhower Years. Dwight Ike Eisenhower, the hero of World War II in Europe, was a moderate Republican with broad popular appeal. His victory in 1952 helped reconcile a large part of the Republican Party, including my parents, with the New Deal. He ushered in what is sometimes portrayed as a return to normal in the U.S. While we were locked in a bipolar Cold War with the Soviet Union, American culture, economic preponderance, and military strength were the foundation of the American century. Eisenhower came into office with modest objectives. He consolidated Truman's doctrine of containment and made it sustainable by a set of prudent judgments, such as avoiding land wars in Korea and Vietnam that later trapped his successors. He strengthened the new alliances with Europe and Japan and was willing to negotiate with the Soviet Union. While he relied on nuclear threats of massive retaliation to offset Soviet conventional superiority in Europe and to save spending on expensive land forces, he was simultaneously very careful in resisting the actual use of nuclear weapons against North Korea and China. Eisenhower understood the limits of American power and managed crises well. Although he used the misleading metaphor of dominoes falling in Southeast Asia, he avoided letting this suck him into major involvement in Vietnam. He considered intervening with air power, nuclear weapons, or ground troops, but finally ruled out acting unilaterally. He kept his
sample complete. Ready to continue?